You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Tom Rath returns to the podcast. He is an author and researcher who studies how careers impact health and well-being. He has written a dozen books or so that have sold more than 10 million copies. He is the co-founder and CEO of CareerSite, and his latest book is called What's the Point? Turning Purpose into Your Daily Superpower. Enjoy the pod. Tom, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be talking to you.
I love the first line of the introduction to your new book. You write, quote, "Most people never uncover their greatest potential. This book exists to prevent that tragedy," end quote. And this mission is deeply personal for you. So, and not something that I knew about or that I think you even talked about in your previous books, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that, you know, I realized when I look back at, you know, a lifetime spent of doing a lot of work and research and books. And it took me a while to really sort out how, even though a lot of us think we find these independent careers and find the right spot after a lot of education and learning and growth, that really most people end up kind of following in the footsteps of either their parents or what they see or the limited exposure that we have. So the more I got into the measurement of this and I was asking my own kids some questions and so forth and saying, you know, well, what careers do you know about? And what do you think you might want to do when you grow up? And when my daughter was 14, she said, well, maybe a writer, what I do, or maybe a teacher, which is what my wife does. So I'm like, you're two for two. And then I started looking at the statistics out there. And I realized that if you look at the jobs that make up the U.S. labor force, and I went to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and did all these data analysis, you would need to see 50 different jobs just to be able to see 50% of what's out there. So most of us are essentially entering the workforce with such limited aperture of what's out there that we're kind of looking through a pinhole. And then we wonder why we get midway through our career and realize we weren't in the right thing. So as I went deeper and deeper on that, what I discovered is that there's a pretty good chance 80-90% of us are making it all the way to the end of our careers without ever discovering where we could have had the most enjoyment and satisfaction. Most importantly, where we could have made the greatest contribution to our communities and to society.
Yeah. And you had an extra thing going on, right? I mean, you as a young person were given a medical diagnosis that doctors said that you wouldn't make it past 40.
Yeah, they said, capsule on that. When I was 16, I was diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder. It essentially shuts off the body's most powerful tumor suppressing gene. And I had cancer in an eye. That's how they discovered it. I lost my left eye to cancer when I was 16. And they said, well, that's not the worst of the news. It turns out that you'll probably have cancer in your kidneys, your pancreas, your spine and adrenal glands, all kinds of stuff. And sure enough, I'm 50 now and I've had cancer or do in most of those areas. And it's been an ongoing battle there. But that got me focused even at a young age on how can I have an impact? What can I do that makes a difference? And trying to build as much life as I could into the 40 years that I thought I'd get at that point. So that had a big influence on me. But what's kind of crazy is that even with that big influence and that deadline and feeling like I need to get a lot done, when I finally did hit age 40 after all that, the over-under, I looked back and said, wait, I've been living everybody else's life that raised me and not my own, which is wild.
Yeah. I mean, I very much love the career that I've had, but it wasn't until I went through personal tragedy that I had to deal with major adversity that I felt like I finally woke up, mm-hmm. and started operating in a way that was like, aligning my values with my purpose. And one of the things that I love about the work here is that, you know, what we recognize, because improvisers have to be thoroughly present in the moment. Mm-hmm. That is, like, you have to be just magically present in the moment. And that is such a better way to live. It means that you are looking to make meaning in everything you do. And, you know, this is our art form and it's our job. And what I recognized way too late in life was like, oh yeah, I should be applying that, you know, off stage. I should be applying that in everything I do. And it's quite frankly, never too late. And right. And this is what this book feels like to me. And again, having read some of your other work, there's a sense of urgency that you're expressing in these pages, not just for yourself, though I'm sure that's where it stems from, but for other people of like, no, do it now.
Yeah.
Do it now. Change the way of what you're doing.
It's today, not even tomorrow, where that's one of the biggest learnings across all the work that I've done is that people always say, well, I have tomorrow to do something. And I mean, really take it from me as someone who's dealt with these challenges. None of us know that we have tomorrow to do something. Yeah. And when you say you do, there's about a 95% chance you're going to put it off and never do it at all. So get something like that done today. And the beautiful thing I learned while getting into the research on this book, I was going to title the book about purpose and talk all about purpose because I thought that was the biggest thing in the context of what we need to do in life. But I realized at some point that most of us, when we hear the word purpose, we kind of clench up and we get anxiety and we think of it as one big grand thing that descends from the heavens on a sunny day or whatever. And when you get into the science of it, it's a lot more helpful to understand that purpose is created in the lab of our daily decisions and our daily interactions with other people. And it is in that moment, to your point, where most of the purpose in life is created. So the minute I got into that and realized that, we changed the title to be about what's the point is kind of just a question to ask yourself throughout the day, because that way you connect it back to purpose being the product of what you're doing every hour throughout the day. And if you think about it that way, it's a lot less intimidating. It takes some of the weight off and it helps you to reprioritize what you do in a given day so that you're doing the meaningful, substantive stuff and having the conversations and interactions that matter instead of just letting external forces dictate your day and sort of sleepwalking through your day, which I do have a real fear when I watch people in airports or in restaurants, whatever, that a lot of us are just kind of allowing external forces and technology and things to drive us and sleepwalking through a day, because sometimes it's more enjoyable, it's easier, it's more entertaining than saying, hey, what's the point of this meeting? Should I be doing that? What's the point of spending 30 minutes responding to emails that I could either automate or maybe I don't need to respond to if that's taking away 30 minutes from a conversation with one of my kids at the end of the day. So, I mean, much like the first book I worked on 25 years ago was called How Full Is Your Bucket? And you still don't even have to read the book to know what that's about, right?
Yeah,
you just right. ask that question of, am I filling someone's bucket or am I taking from it? You don't even have to read an article or a web page to get it. And that's what I was trying to get to here, was to give people a quick way to say, what's the point of what I'm doing every hour throughout the day? And if there's not a substantive, purposeful meaning to it, then find a way to automate it, do something else, reprioritize things so you do get to build purpose and pack it into every single day, basically.
All right, so let's unpack some of these words. Words are powerful. Mm-hmm. Much like when you talk about the models that we've got for us in terms of what our parents did for our jobs and that maybe limit our scope, we also have these words that we get sort of anchored to. And one of those is passion. And we're in that place right now where there's a bunch of college commencement speeches that we're seeing pop mm-hmm. up online. A lot of people are talking about following your passion. And you call passion, quote, a first world problem dressed up as wisdom. Unpack that for us, because I tend to agree with you.
Well, I mean, you know, I first watched a brilliant graduation speech by the venture capitalist Ben Horowitz, who founded Andreessen Horowitz, maybe 5-6 years ago. And he was talking about how instead of following your passion, you need to follow your contribution. And that really struck me, that passion is about what you want to do, who you are. I might be passionate about golf or basketball or traveling or whatnot. That doesn't really make a difference for people in the world. And if you're thinking about getting a job and serving a purpose, no employer is going to hire you because you walk out of the a university career center and say, I want the world to revolve around my passions and who I am. Those organizations want to know how you can contribute and make their customers' lives better, their clients' lives better, their communities better. And if you talk in that language of the demand side of the equation of what the world needs, instead of the supply side, I think purpose and meaning are rich and inherently other-oriented pursuits, where passion is, in many cases, can just be more self-oriented and self-serving. And we got to get out of that self-orientation mode if we want to make a difference and get a job. And, you know, the more I've talked about this recently and thought about it, I also think that at an individual level, saying I'm just going to focus on and explore my passions is kind of lazy intellectually. Because it's, I mean, that may sound too blunt for this generation, but it means that you're not trying to widen your field of view and you're not trying to stretch your aperture and you're not thinking about all the things that are out there that are needed in the world and how you can serve a purpose, because you're kind of taking that approach of things should come to me based on what you know. And even if I sent someone through an inventory of what they're passionate about when they're 18 or 21 years old, they're probably not even qualified to answer that survey, because they just don't know what they don't know and they haven't even seen what's out there. So I think we've got to take a little more ownership as individuals and as educators and teachers, and parents need to do it too, to say it's our job to help young people try and get a little bit more exposure to the things that are out there that the world needs, so we do a better job of matching the two. If we just keep doing what we're doing right now, I would venture to guess that the United States would be better off if we just figured out really good random assignment of people when they graduate from high school. Mm-hmm. Because it might turn out just as well as what we're doing right now.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the battle. It's funny, because this idea comes up a lot on the podcast, because a lot of behavioral scientists who are a lot of our guests write about the what they know. At the end of the day, it's about our relationships. Mm-hmm. That is going to be the difference in terms of how happy or not we are. And this cult of individualism that has existed inside this country has always been a myth.
Right.
This idea that it was one guy who did the thing, the great man theory. And like, Steve Jobs did not invent the iPhone. I mean, his contributions are amazing. Someone else invented that. Right. And, you know, he knew how to package it. That's great. But it was like a lot of people's hands are on these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are fighting, to a certain extent, human behavior, in terms of our default is to do nothing often, to not act. So you're fighting that kind of human behavior. You're fighting a sort of a cultural idea, societal idea. And especially right now, right? I mean, this feels like we're awash in a cult of, you know, it's mine, don't touch it. And what I want to say to these people, it's like, you didn't pave the roads you're walking on.
Right.
And I mean that broadly.
Yep.
And I don't know, I know the work we do is certainly ensemble oriented. I'm curious, in your own journey, when that kicked in, that this is always about others and being others focused. Is that something that you kind of had an inkling of before? Or was it something that kicked in later in life?
You know, it's been an evolution of learning for me. I was fortunate enough to grow up around some of the world's leading psychologists. My grandfather was one of them, and a lot of his friends and colleagues. And Marty Seligman was first student in his graduate program at Penn, and knew all these great old psychologists, and they all had their own thing, and they disagreed on stuff all the time. And it was rare they had consensus on anything. But the one thing that every single one of them would agree on and not even debate is that social relationships are the single biggest determinant of our overall satisfaction and well-being in life. Right. And so the thing I learned from all that work and research is that we are 100% other made. And I've got a whole chapter in this new What's the Point book that's about, I call it shoulder hunting, where your job is to go out and find some shoulders to stand on, because nothing's really created just out of thin air. It's exactly what you were talking about. And really, I mean, even all the work that I've been a part of on people developing their strengths and the like, my grandfather taught me when I was young that our strengths really only matter in the context of a relationship, because that's how we relate to people, and it's what we do, and it's how people grow. And so if I could just suggest one through line from all the research I've read and all the books that I've worked on and so forth, it would be that the earlier on in life that you can get your orientation from being more self-oriented to more other-oriented, whether you're talking about your purpose, your mission, focusing on other people instead of your happiness, that's the one thing that will most rapidly get you to a place where you feel like you've had a meaningful day, you have good connections with other people, and you feel good about where you are in life overall. also talk in this book about how, I live across the street from a cemetery here in Arlington, Virginia, and I walk through there sometimes when I just need some peace of mind with without the dog, without earbuds in or anything, and really think about things. And I've walked by, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 headstones there, and they all talk about a beloved father and a husband, someone who contributes to the community. None of it is about those individualistic metrics about finances and followers and titles and all that stuff. So if you really wake up in the morning and say, what's the point? What matters? Most people come back to relationships. They come back to family and they admit those are the things that matter. Okay. Well, how do you orient your actual time and distribution of what you do during the day to better match those values that we state and that we talk about and that we care about? And so asking that question of myself about why am I doing this for the next 30 minutes has helped to be a pretty powerful guide in my day over the last couple of years, at least, to say, how do I make sure that I'm front end loading the stuff that really will matter at the end of this journey before I do all the responsive bill paying, responding to emails and so forth at 3 or 4 in the clock in the afternoon, if I have time.
Right. One of my favorite people that the late great Harold Ramis, and one of the gifts of working at Second City is you get to hang out with these people. Yeah. And I remember asking Harold this a long time ago, I was like, what piece of advice would you give someone sort of entering this world? And I was a young person just getting into the field. And he said, in his experience, you find the funniest person in a room and you stand next to them. And for him, that was John Belushi. That was the person who was in his ensemble that he did. But he meant it more broadly. And I think it's perfect in terms of what you're talking about, because it is both that sort of others focused idea, but it's also, no, like, stand next to them, move. Mm-hmm. And you talk about practice. And I think that's one of the things that people maybe miss out on these ideas, is that the ideas are great. They mean nothing if you don't act, and you do. And just thinking about regret, it's like, believe me, you're not going to regret your modes of action. You are going to regret your modes of inaction.
Right. And I also, to your point about who you stand next to, I think especially as you get into middle life and later on, you got to challenge yourself to step back and look for people you could stand on the shoulders of, not just people who you would mentor or listen to you, because no matter where you are in your life, like I'm challenging myself lately to look for 5-10 people who are a lot better than I ever will be at certain things, and to continue to learn from them at any stage in your career, because that's the kind of growth that really challenges you and you can begin to keep building on. So, I mean, it seems like that's something that you never get to a point where you can stop doing that.
No. Yeah. Let's also talk about well-roundedness and this idea, because I know at certain points in my career, I'm always very clear about what I'm good at and what I'm not good at. And I'm very uninterested in working on the things I'm not good at. And I've had bosses in the past who are like, hey, you should really learn how to, you know, work an Excel spreadsheet. And I'm like, should I? Mm-hmm. Is that a really good use of my time? Because I feel like, you know, that's like telling someone who doesn't know how to tell a story that they should be a great storyteller. It's like, right. maybe let the storytelling happen for me, who's good at it and enjoys it. And that's something you talk about as well in the book.
Yeah. I mean, I think the right answer for most of us all the way along has been to find out what you're best at and double and triple down on that. And then it's traditionally been a good idea to say, okay, if you have a team of people, let's say I'm really good at kind of ideating, thinking of new stuff, and I'm not great at building, sustaining, maintaining relationships, I need to have someone on my work team that's better, much better than I ever will be at that, so they can help complement my biggest weaknesses there, right? And if I need someone who's really good at executing and getting things done and being a task manager, I know I need that piece on the team. So the individual basically doesn't need to be well-rounded and can't, time-wise and so forth, but you might need a team to be more well-rounded. The one thing that I'm learning on that that's new in the last 6 to 12 months is I do think that we can use AI-driven tools and LLMs to begin to fill in some of those weaknesses and gaps as well, and look at that in the same way. You're talking about bills and spreadsheets and accounting and kind of project management tools and so forth. Well, I'm learning as much about, in addition to the people on my team that I need from a relationship standpoint and so forth, how can I use new technology and tools to manage around and automate and take care of a lot of the things that'll free me up to spend more time doing what I do best. And that's a new learning for an old dog in this day and age.
Oh, totally. I mean, I just wrote a piece for Forbes. It hasn't, I just sent it in, so I haven't gotten my notes yet, but it's essentially, I think I open it by saying I'm not an AI doomer. Mm-hmm. However, I also work in the creative industries, and there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of angst around right. these tools, and quite rightly so, for a variety of reasons. And the thing I write about is I remember when we first got wired for the internet at Second City, and a 16-year-old genius kid who was in the teen troupe was doing the wiring and setting up this thing called a website. The vast majority of people at Second City were like, what is he doing? Like, why would you even do this? And the one person who actually was interested in this was a young actor on the main stage by the name of Stephen Colbert. And Colbert made me buy like a number of extension cords and a cart that we put a computer on that we would roll out on the stage for the improv set so he could take improv suggestions from the World Wide Web. And it was a total disaster. It didn't work. Yeah. Like, it took forever him to get to a chat room to just get a vulgar suggestion. Like, yeah. you could have done that with the second guy in the row, you know, front row, yeah. who would give that to you. But it was the experience of getting it wrong mm-hmm. that then led to other kinds of discoveries, like doing short form videos, which then became hugely important in the comedy world, right. And the internet. And the one thing AI is not good at is getting it wrong in a powerful and positive way,
right.
and knowing what to do with wrong. Yep. And I think, you know, in reading in this particular book, one of the reasons it's so good is it really covers a lot of territory mm-hmm. In terms of this, but it is about those crunchy, odd things that you can only experience when you put a device down,
right,
and talk to another person. And there's so, you know, the bad habits we've gotten into, that social media, social comparison, all those things are just not going to help you on your journey.
Right. Yeah. And I think, you know, to the device point, I'm seeing something parallel, like you talked about with the internet, which is a good way to think about it. I mean, so many people right now, I watch people go through in their days, whether they're walking through my neighborhood or in an airport, and they're essentially letting the device run them and run their day. And they're dependent on and responsive to the device. And that interrupts their conversations, it interrupts their creativity, and interrupts their learning, all these things. And so the people who have even more value as good managers and leaders and creatives and developers of other people are going to be the ones who are able to disconnect, put the device down, and use it when they need it as a tool. But they're the ones orchestrating and managing and driving what's going on with the device. And I'm seeing personally a similar pattern with AI, where if people simply stay in fear and keep their heads down and assume that AI is going to threaten their job and they're just responding, they're going to be the first ones who are at risk versus the people who are taking up the challenge and saying, how can I use this to free me up to be my best so I can spend more time on the things that matter most and have tools that manage around that as much as possible. But exactly to your point, when you see these big shifts, there are going to be ways for it to be very productively applied if we can have the agency and the ownership and creativity to say we're going to stay in charge of utilizing that for a greater good that serves others.
Controlling your time, hugely important. A thing that I played with, and it was after we had a podcast guest talk about this, is I do more time blocking on my calendar than I mm-hmm. used to, which is literally like, oh, I'm actually going to put in lunch. So don't put anything on my calendar between 12 and 1, because and if something comes up, I can move it or whatever. Someone can call that. And I'm curious, is there ways that you have used the technology to help control the technology as it relates to your time?
Yeah. You know, the thing, there was an episode of Charlie Rose 10 years ago where he was in his studio and he had Warren Buffett and Bill Gates on with him. And Bill Gates tapped Warren Buffett at some point in the interview and said, in response to a question, said, Warren, show him your little diary, your calendar. And Warren takes out this little handheld calendar and he's like, show him Tuesday, show him Wednesday. And he just had these huge blocks in his calendar of complete free time. So you've got the richest guy in the world there, two of the richest men in the world. And Warren's saying that the real luxury is the richness of time there, to have those big blocks, to have that creative thought, to do those things. And just watching that interview seared into my brain so deeply that no matter where you get in life, the real freedom is to be able to, my team knows that I try and block out my entire mornings 3 or 4 days out of a week just to do substantive stuff, whether that's writing a book, editing a book, doing research. I count learning into that, just an hour or two of learning, building a new application. And then we get to more of the catching up and responsive things in our, we try and block meetings early to mid afternoon. And then I do more of the responsive catching up later on in the day. But I've really restructured everything to make sure that I at least have a few hours each morning where I do stuff that I can feel good about at the end of the day. And like I actually produce something that might be useful to another human being a week from now or maybe even a month from now.
I'm reading, I think I stored it in my backpack. Ron Friedman's got a book that's called Super Teams, and I just started it. He is anti-meeting across the board. And I kind of love it because he's laying out all the reasons you don't need to have a meeting.
Right.
And he also, he's got a line of like, meetings are like the gift to procrastinators. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh yeah, that's what you're calling all of us into this room. So you don't have to think about this thing because these meetings require pre-work and then you get in there and they're taking up time. And I wonder if this is all you write in the book, you say, quote, true focus requires true absence, end quote. That's what you're talking about with that. But that's the kind of absence,
yeah,
right?
I'll take that a step further. I love Ron's work and know him pretty well. I think you should ask what's the point of any meeting at the start of it before you even have that meeting. If there's not a real good, clear answer, don't do it. Just don't waste
it.
Right? Yeah. But when I meet new teams and we work with a new subcontractor, software development firm, whatever it might be, I tell them explicitly, every email that I don't get is a gift from above. And that's how I look at my days, because that's one more thing that's just getting away. So let's focus on the meaty stuff, the substantive things, and not just the procedural, so that we're all making sure to value our time and focus on what matters as much as possible. And I think the more we can be open and objective and clinical about that, and there's been a lot of good work done on the way Amazon over the years has made sure that every meeting is actually serving a decision-making purpose and people come insanely prepared because everyone's agreed it's that important, and to set a higher bar for a lot of the things that we do, because that, I mean, if any of us have, if I would rather spend 30 minutes talking to someone who works for me about where they are in their career and their growth and development and investing in them as an individual than I would going through a meeting that's about a topic I might not need to be a part of, right? And to think about some of those trade-offs, even going outdoors for a walk for 30 minutes probably offsets, that might be more important for our creativity than half the meetings we take in a day. And you to think about the balance of that is important.
So it's funny. I've been talking so much about walking. So I had open heart surgery 13 weeks ago. And one of the things they tell you in terms of your recovery is like, walk more. Cause you're not able to like I used to lift weights and I can get back to that eventually, but they're like, walk. I have been taking these long walks and I actually was doing it before the surgery as just like tune up stuff too, to make sure I was going strong. And I'm taking like an afternoon walk and I used to never do that more. And just, it's not just the body, but the mind the ideas that come and you're in nature and it is such an undervalued period of time. And you talk in the book, you say all time is not created equal. And I would suggest like a 30-minute walk is probably the equivalent of like a 4 or 5 hour part of your work day in terms of value.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the kind of cognitive energy you get from that. And people always ask me like, what's the key to a real productive day where you're focused on purposeful stuff? And my quick answer is always making sure I'm in bed in a cold room with lights out at 10 o'clock the night before is the key to that whole day, because it really starts there. If you work back from that, you get a decent 7 or 8 hours. If you can, you get up the next morning, you get some activity, you get outdoors, you get some light. It's just kind of like the snowball effect where everything becomes a progressive upward spiral. If you get the right sleep, you get the activity, you have some good conversations, you do some meaningful work, those things just continue to build and build and build. Whereas if you've had a completely disrupted 4 or 5 hours sleep, you have about a 20% chance of having the same decent day. So it's those things matter so much more for even good conversations and teamwork and productivity than we talk about in that context very often.
One of the things you also say in the book is people should learn to ask good questions. Mm-hmm. So for you, what's the art of asking a good question?
I think the art of asking a good question is saying, based on what you know about that person and who they are and what you've seen and observed and what you've seen them do well, how can you help them to talk about that and bring it out and help people to see things that they might otherwise not have noticed? And then the most important part of it is to dedicate time to asking that question, to have your device stowed away in a pocket where it doesn't even come out. It's not on the table. It's not visible. It's not vibrating, anything else. And then to close your mouth as long as you humanly and possibly can, and to genuinely listen to that response and pay attention and help someone to think that through. I, as a parent, as a manager, as someone doing creative things, I think that might be the single most valuable thing I can do in a given day for another person.
And this is another thing that I've thought about with regard to where does a place like Second City exist in relation to AI? And one of the things that great improvisers know is the vernacular we use is getting a get. And it's when you ask a question to the audience and you want them to give you something that you will then improvise on. And the way you solicit that is hugely important, because you can get something really stupid or, you know, not very useful to you, or you can inspire someone to give you something sort of real and interesting. And you know, in terms of AI, the vernacular will be prompt. You're like, what's that prompt? And I think this is where the most human of things, which is being storytellers, allows us to also make that relationship with AI go both ways,
right?
Because that's where the interesting stuff will happen, and it requires like lift on both ends. But we just don't. That's not something that necessarily I think is being taught in business school, and it probably should.
Absolutely.
I'll always end the podcast normally for our first time guests, and you've been here before, with a yes and story. But the guests, when they return, we ask if you could share a thank you because story, a time in your life where maybe you're in a difficult conversation and you decided to use some gratitude and seeing the other person as a way to sort of stay inside that conversation and see what happened. I'm curious what your story might be for us.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's kind of timely too, and fits into our discussion, because as soon as I got deep into using Claude Cowork in particular as a tool 6-12 months ago, and realized that this isn't kind of about chat or anything, it's about building stuff that matters and can help me to scale and do more and do things faster and everything else, and got really obsessed and into that, I realized that it was going to change the way I do almost everything. As someone that owns a publishing company and writes a lot of books, we can make that go a lot faster. We can scale a lot more. We can do more with content. We can build better applications faster. We can build new websites rapidly and not pay other people to host and manage all that. And the minute I got into that personally and saw that, I realized that there are a group of people who I've worked with for a long time that work for me in startups that I work with, and that was going to challenge and change the relationship that we have. Because if I can pay $20 a month for a tool that can do a lot of these things from, let's just take an editorial or website development capacity, that's just going to change the way we work with one another, because I'm not going to pay 100 times more when I don't need to, right? And so as I started to talk to my teams about what I was learning, I realized in the first weeks that as I kind of read the soft signals and talked to them, that of course that's an intimidating conversation I'm having, right? And I could tell them, like, if I was them, I put myself in their shoes, I would be scared in the back of my mind and say, is this going to continue to work in kind of an employment context and what we're doing and everything else? And I talked to a few of my partners about, you know, I can tell a few people are already feeling that and I'm sensing it. Should we just have some open conversations, just put all the cards on the table? And so I went and had individual conversations. Then we had some as a group to say, it's probably 8-9 months ago now, to say, I've realized that I individually, Tom, can do at least 3 to 5 times as much as I could 6 months ago, maybe 5 to 10 times. And so I'm realizing that I need to figure out and challenge myself how to perform at least 5x my capacity from 2005. And I was real open about, what are you thinking? How are you doing? And I told each of the people I've worked with the longest amount that I love working with you. I love the relationship. I love the partnership. One of the people I've worked with for 30 years now, my business partner. And I want to keep doing that, because working with people is the most fun. It's what makes work worthwhile. But in order for this to all work economically, every one of us needs to get up to the speed that I'm at right now, whether it's through training, we do weekly show and tell of what each person's building. It's about building new tools and stuff. And we all need to get up to the 5X speed. So the five of us need to turn into 25 or 50 of us. And if we can do that, then we can reach a lot more people that supports it. And we all get to continue to work together for a long, long time. And so I kind of put that out there, let it marinate for a while, and then had a bunch of individual conversations about how I could help each person to get up to speed and to do more and to jump all in the same way that I'd been doing. And so far that's worked out pretty good, but it seems like one of those things where the faster you move and the more disclosure, that helps a lot, because then it builds more trust into the relationships essentially.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, it's tough because it is, A, you have the problem of not everyone understands it. Mm-hmm. And we know when we don't understand something, one of our human things is to like move away.
Right.
But then if you have the kind of relationships that you're talking about that you have, you can have those conversations with people, and also you're giving people a bit of a superpower. If they can take off the drudgery, which is essentially what a lot of this stuff is, we realized in a conversation the other day that AI is going to help us with really keep down our legal bills, mm-hmm. because it can make contracts. Yeah. And it's like, this is not complicated stuff. Someone's just giving you a template. Take right. the template. And by the way, and this is something I know, I don't know if you feel the same way, which is like, people break contracts all the time, whether the contract exists or not. Right. So if that's the thing you're worried about, I would worry more about the relationship, which, by the way, AI can't help.
Right.
So the book is fantastic. It's called What's the Point? Turning Purpose into Your Daily Superpower. Tom Rath, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Kelly, thanks so much. Great discussion.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Aridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.